Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 23rd, 2003. Today's session is Lord of the Landfill, God of the Garbage Heap. Session 3 of Poetry and the Healing Power of Salvage and Detritus, presented by Steve Ringo. The number is RIS 2003-08. Let's listen in.
Because I didn't want to carry it.
So the blue didn't happen. This is wonderful.
Was something I put on to carry.
I love it.
There is an old shed up there. Has anybody been up there to Copper Falls?
Yeah, Copper Falls.
And is that a mining shed that they used to do some mining? It's a metal.
Dam, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it was the original Virgin Dam. But the
thank you.
Well, it's got water, some. It's
still more power and water comes from that.
Okay.
I think that was the first house.
Oh, that's
interesting things there.
There's a new one.
6 o'clock, so I'm going to say burn it, Tom. And my name is Steve Ringo. This is session 3 out of 5 under the title Poetry and the Healing Power of Salvage and Detritus. That was so nice of you to bring that. That's a wonderful piece, like an old...
I did. I like the red.
Yeah. It has an R and a 2 on it.
R2.
And an R3 on the other side. And it's kind of foamy. And the...
Interesting.
Wow. Now, before we jump in, let's say this. Can everybody read this, or should I just read it? Since it says our, I think we should read it together, if you can. Are you ready? To survive,
our minds must face dreadwood and egg, octopi, bat, and the bat's mouth, insect. It's hard to think.
I think it starts in like a poem, and then what happened here is James Bertolini teamed up with Harold Belays, a Spokane artist who actually has works all over the country, and they got together to do a commissioned work and presentations and whatnot for an ecological cause that was happening maybe 8 years ago in Spokane. And he wrote this text, and Harold Belays incorporated it into a piece of metal sculpture that he did. So the last couple lines, I think, had a little pedantic or sermonic, if you will. Not fair to say that. But the rest of it, I think, has a beautiful invitation to what it means to become a healed planet, a healed creation. In our first session this week, we talked about creation under this larger theme and the created order, and that called that the what article of the creed? Anybody was here? First article. And the second article of the creed was yesterday, which just got us jump-started into discussion about what happens in the first, in the second article, what's the activity that's happening? Redemption, salvation, freedom, liberation. Adoption, we mentioned a whole bunch of names of the kind of things that are saving acts or verbs. And then the third article is today, and tomorrow actually. But today, the title, which is on your front sheet there, did everybody get a handout? There you go. Makes me feel better if you have something in your hands. Yeah, I don't know why. But the landfill is the key word here. And Ed, you might start crying, that's okay, I have Kleenex up here somewhere. The landfill. I went on garbology the second day of my 2 weeks here at Holden, and Ed was just a graceful, gracious, patient garbology mentor and showed us how to do the sorting and whatnot, but there was a certain bin where the landfill items. What kind of items from Holden would go to landfill?
Just
plastic,
right? Is most all of it plastic? What else would qualify? Batteries.
All my pins.
Pans.
Which is plastic.
Plastic,
I guess.
I suppose the others is burnable and compostable. And isn't there a fourth one?
Well, recycle.
Yeah, recycle. So. The key word in landfill, which I think is really a euphemism, a landfill is sort of a soft way of saying what happens in a landfill, isn't it? How many of you have actually been to a landfill? Raise your hand. It's worth doing just to know because we're all contributors, aren't we? That's our place. We put stuff in the garbage and we kind of forget it because the big truck that's mostly automated nowadays comes and does that thing and then you just forget it, right? When, what do you see at the landfill and what do you smell and what do you hear?
Seagulls.
Trucks. Diesel.
Garbage. Diapers.
Bulldozers. Yeah. Just mounds and mounds and layers and the smell is kind of overpowering.
Dust.
Somebody said something else?
Dust.
Dust, yes.
Often in other countries you see people picking through it.
Yeah, you do. Some rag picker salvagers. Yeah, something like this. So we talked yesterday about reclaiming and how redemption can happen not just with people but with the created order, that in that first article of creation, God creates, but then the redemption happens when we are forgiven, or we are healed, or we are reconciled, or we are adopted. But also the created order is in need of salvation in a sense too, and that I think a truncated view of sin and redemption is one that is strictly just for people. That and if you look in Revelation, other passages, the whole earth, the whole world, the creation itself groans with eager longing for redemption and adoption. Is that semi-accurate? And that the whole created order is redeemable and in being redeemed. So that reclamation project is God's too for the whole earth. And these little things like you did to reclaim that, that gives it a new life. And it doesn't have a life. That would be animistic. But maybe it can contribute to pleasure or to something else or to the healing of relationships, the healing of a community. I don't know. That's a stretch. But I think there's an idea there. So Jubilee is tomorrow too, so I think there's a real nice connection today to discussion about the land, and that the land was being redeemed in the Jubilee year, that is the 49th year. Seven is always a magic number in the Old Testament, right? Seventh day God did what? Rested from the creation. And the seventh day is the Sabbath day because of the day of rest, partly. But the seventh year was the sabbatical year, right? Sabbath, sabbatical. So if you're a professor, you hopefully get a sabbatical if your college is treating you right. And then the 7 times 7 is what happened to make the Jubilee. Is that halfway?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 7 times 7 plus 1.
Yeah. So at the end of the 7 times 7, I guess it ushered in that Jubilee year. But so Jubilee, we celebrate that the land and the blessedness of the land, the way the land blesses us. And did they leave it fallow, or did they and forgave debts of land? And maybe what other things did they do with land in the Jubilee?
Who is they? I'm sorry.
The Israelites, okay. The people of the Old Testament.
People could come home to your ancestral lands.
There you go.
And get out the way of folks who were coming.
So you lost it. Yeah. Susan and,
Michael?
Michael. They were talking about that, too, for the Palestinians coming home. So let's dive in. Turn the page. And I want to start with the one on the right-hand side, how metaphor can save your life. And then we'll move over to the left to the Howard Nimmerow poem after that. I'm going to plant a seed to, I'll read this poem, but if you want to do some reading as we go through some of these, and we won't have time for all of them, feel free to, I'll give you a chance to volunteer, so keep that in mind. How metaphor can save your life. You are drowning. Someone throws you an inflatable sunset, which momentarily distracts you from the sinking ship. The cramp in your left leg, the barracuda who has just sidled up next to you. You forget that you do not know how to swim. You're thrashing about, your simulated swimming strokes bring out the Coast Guard. You find a small tumor behind your left earlobe. The dark clouds of cancer descends. Just as the doctor tells you, you have Dutch elm disease and need to wash more frequently behind your ears. You have just lost your job. You have no money in the bank. Eat love, someone has written on the bulletin board at the unemployment office. A man proposes on the hard bench. You accept and live happily ever afterward. You are on an airplane. Suddenly it hits an air pocket and drops 1,000 feet into a cloud bank. You climb out of the window. You have always wanted to touch a cloud. You hold yourself aloft by doing yoga. Soon your parachute opens. You sail safely through a grove of redwood trees. Your arms full of cumulonimbus towers from the cloud bank. You learn that the Dow Jones is up. Okay, she is having some fun here, isn't she? What do you think about anything in here? Simple, complicated, medium, a word, a phrase, anything? Should we start with the title? The title smacks of something you might see at the grocery store checkout line, huh? Like, how to lose 50 pounds in a month. It's a how-to. It's kind of bemusing, I think, the how-to part of it. Self-help kind of idea, right? And a lot of those promises that you see at the grocery line are very inflated, aren't they? And to first reading, this is very exaggerated, don't you think? How a metaphor can save your life. Well, I really think she's serious. What happens in that first stanza? Anything kind of odd?
Inflatable sunset.
Yeah, kind of funny. Fantastical, huh? Mm-hmm. Imagination. It also sounds sort of like this kind of thing Madison Avenue might actually make. True. You know, you could find one of those maybe at Toys R Us, an inflatable sunset. But I think she kind of means it in a certain way that we'll get to. The sinking ship. There's a lot of fear mixed in with the humor, maybe. The sinking ship, the barracuda, not knowing how to swim, thrashing about, then the Coast Guard comes because you're thrashing. And then the small tumor, this is my favorite stanza, is the small tumor behind your left earlobe. Very localized, right? The dark cloud of cancer, and then the cloud comes back at you again in the last stanza, right? The dark cloud descends as the doctor tells you, you have Dutch elm disease. I think it personalizes it a lot more than the inflatable sunset. And I think what she's doing here is blending our own body and our own life with the earth, with the world, that our life is intricately tied up with the sunset and intricately tied up with the Dutch elm tree and intricately tied up with the ocean and the person that's sitting there on the wooden bench at the park. I really think that's what she's saying, but it's a metaphor, isn't it? You don't really have Dutch elm disease. But if you can think that, and this gets you to some other kinds of metaphysical poets and whatnot, but we as human beings have the freedom to think that, don't we? We can actually think like a planet. We can think, and obviously I can't become a bat. I can't know what that tastes like in the bat's mouth. But if I can try to imagine and think like a Dutch elm, or feel for it, or in my imagination. And kids have the power, little kids, of knowing that's real. We get to a point in our lives where we think it's just pretend. It's fantasy. Where really, if you want it to be real, you can make the imagination part of it a real metaphor. So the metaphor is a metaphor, but it is. Does that make sense? So that's what he means by thinking like a planet. You can't taste the bat's mouth, but you can imagine what it is like and therefore be more bat-like or more compassionate for the bat, the redwood, the octopus. Does that make any sense at all?
Mm-hmm.
So the power of metaphor is still a metaphor, but it can heal, it can unite, and it can take you places where a lot of us don't, maybe, you know, we don't let ourselves get there sometimes. We put on the, you know, the 8-to-5 or the whatever blinders we might have. The airplane, the unemployment office. Now I've talked too much. What do you want? What do you think about this? Anybody?
The eat love thing was the mm-hmm. thing that stood out to me in the entire poem.
Yeah, capital letters too.
Yeah. This,
say some more about that.
But just this, sort of this poverty. You know, you've just lost your job. You have no money in the bank. But, you know, I picture this as a kind of a sarcastic
right.
remark. You, and because you can't eat love, it, you
right.
know, it doesn't nourish you in the way that.
Yeah.
Bread does, but it nourishes you in some of these metaphorical ways as well. And here's an invitation to accept it, to live in this metaphor. And
sure.
Yeah, I think that's I think it's beautiful.
Doesn't eat love reflect the title of the poem in a way too?
Mm-hmm.
To if metaphor can save your life, maybe you can eat love in a sense.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a metaphor there, and think of communion, Eucharist,
mm-hmm.
eating love. I like the cloud bank again, brings back the clouds you heard about earlier, but then there's the play on that word, cloud bank,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Dow Jones is up.
I like the way when it says and drops, then they drop the line out.
Right.
That's cool.
I know it.
That's
is.
Really good.
That's good. I'm glad you saw that.
Yeah.
1,000 feet, she just gives us a double space, but you
awesome.
Climb out the window. Tactile there, wanting to touch the cloud. That's like this, you know, wanting to touch, wanting to be there. And obviously you can't just do that, but you can, the metaphor can take you.
See, that was good too. You can live, instead of saying, and live happily ever after, they say afterward.
Right, yeah, I agree.
All the words.
She didn't say after, she said afterward. Mm-hmm. Thanks for saying that. So she kind of takes a little shot at some of our presumptions, doesn't she? Let's go to the first poem on the left-hand side. Anybody care to read the first stanza, or first and second, or we could wrote?
Sure.
Ed, would you like to read them both?
Is it the look fish?
No, the cabinet of seeds on the the very first one.
Oh.
Seeds. Oh, okay.
Thank you.
There are original monies of the earth, in which invested as the spark in fire, they will produce a green wealth toppling tall. A trick they do by dying, by decay, in burial, becoming each his kind to rise in glory and be magnified a million times above the obscure grave. Reader, these samples are exhibited for contemplation. Locked in potency, kept from act for reverence sake. May they remind us while we live on earth that all economies are primitive, and by their reservations, may they teach our governors who speak of husbandry and think the hurricane where power lies.
The word economy is an interesting word in a poem, I think. And then husbandry is a sort of old-fashioned word for animal husbandry. I remember as a Boy Scout getting an animal husbandry, a little merit badge, you know, and put it on your sash. And I have heard the word husbandry related to plants. Any other husbandry applications? It's weird that we don't apply it to families too much. I got the message, didn't I?
Ouch!
So. Got that, Tom?
Those are the seeds, aren't they?
Yeah. I'll close the door. A cabinet of seeds. So the cabinet of seeds,
yeah.
that's maybe sort of old school too, isn't it? Display. Display shows some organizational, kind of catalogical, systematic going about it, right? When you put something in that kind of order. These are the original monies of Earth. So that keep that monies in mind with the economy in which invested, another economic term, as the spark in fire. He juxtaposes economic terms with terms of nature, the fire, the wealth of the wealth, top of it all in the fire. Is that what it's connected to in that sentence? From the seeds, right? The seeds turn into what is it? Seed needs don't fires release a lot of seeds? I think that's
certain pine trees.
There you go. The allusion here, I think, is that fire has to.
Well, green mouth toppling tall. Does that refer to tall trees?
I suppose. From which the seeds came.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just came
or,
from the seed.
Or the seed is to the tall tree as the spark is to the fire.
Okay, I like that. A trick they do, I like the word trick. It's not as crass as invested, is it? Mm-hmm. By dying, by decay, the seed has to die in order to rise. What's the hymn that we sing around Christmas time? Now the green blade rises from the buried grain. The death of winter and then the rising in spring. The hymn we sang last night that Dan and her brokering wrote about the seasons being named and then in the spring we all rise again. It's kind of haunting and hopeful at the same time. To rise in glory and be magnified. So this seed, this tiny little seed, dies, is kind of singed by fire, but then after the burial, a trick, the rising again from the obscure grave, magnified in glory. And then, after setting all that kind of mixed mishmash from this cabinet of seeds, he says directly to you, directly to us, reader, these samples, and I think they're samples, almost like a metaphor can save your life, a sample. He's using a sample, he's making it a metaphor, isn't he? These samples are exhibited, another kind of Latinate, crept more dry kind of business-like word for contemplation. But what are they? Locked in potency and kept from act for reverence sake.
You have to remember the title of the poem, though. I see it as a cabinet of seeds that you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
A cabinet of seeds displayed.
Yeah. These samples, these seeds,
yeah.
Right? Exhibited.
They're exhibited for contemplation. Mm-hmm. They're locked up for us to look at and think about.
And what do? They may remind us while we live on Earth. Think about Earth again here, living like a planet. While we live here, that all economies are primitive. And by their reservations, I think by their, almost like by their shyness or their simpleness or their non-complexity, they teach our governors, our leaders, our rulers, who speak of husbandry, who, you know, try to sound caring, compassionate, thousand points of light, all that. They speak that way, but what do they think? They think the hurricane, they power. So it's a juxtaposition of that kind of economic governmental power versus the power of God in creation and the power of God in the small economies of people gathering like this or gathering around the Eucharist or gathering to pray or gathering to hike or just share or whatever people gather to do that takes us toward God. Let's go to a simpler one, and then we'll flip back to Rumi. I think this one, flip two pages down to the one by Antler, where it says, Prove to Me, and Mother Hummingbird. Any of you familiar with Antler? Ogallala Sioux poet from the native tradition, obviously, and he's writing on this same theme of economies and money versus nature, and in a more, I think, a more plain as day kind of way. As I read this poem, and I'll have someone else read the other one, the Proof to Me poem, as I read it, try to catch the financial, the words that are used in the financial world. Prove to me, in a single blizzard, more snowflakes fall than all the money produced in the history of the world. In a single fall, more leaves fall than all the money produced in the history of the world. In this universe alone, not counting universes before and after, and universes concurrent with this universe, more planets with utopias on them exist than all the money produced in human history. Explain to me why snow can't be used as money. Explain to me why each fallen leaf can't be pecuniary remuneration. Prove to me beyond the shadow of a doubt why the epiphany zillions of planets have utopias on them can't be legal tender. Why can't I fill my cart with food and after the girl rings up my bill, give her a pine cone? Why can't I knock on my landlord's door and hand him a flower for rent? And when the police take me away and demand to see my identification, what else can I do but reach into my pocket and present them a handful of sand running through my fingers? Hmm. What are the natural objects that come up in this poem? The stuff from nature.
Pine cone.
Leaves.
Flowers.
Sand.
Leaves.
Snow.
Planet. And what are the financial terms?
Money.
Pecuniary remuneration.
Counting. Remuneration. Pecuniary remuneration is a pretty.
Legal tender.
Legal tender. There you go. Rent. Landlord and rent kind of have that overtone.
Bill.
Rings up my bill. You can almost hear the ring in the old kind of cash register, maybe. I think it takes another turn at the end. Maybe the way he's living or thinking he can live gets him in trouble with the law, right? And what do they ask for identification, and he pulls the ultimate card, the sand running through his fingers. Now, when the Genesis account talks about, when one of the Genesis accounts talks about our own creation, one of them talks about how God does what with the sand? Breathes into the dirt, the breath of life, and makes the human from dust. And at the funeral, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Why? Because it's back to where we came from. It completes the cycle of life. It's life and death is a oneness, is a unity of a cycle, not a, you know, split off thing like we tend to make it. So what's he giving him? His ID is really, I think that truly is a great sense of identification. It's back to this, you know. That's where I'm from. Very native point of view, but also biblical, Hebrew, maybe. What do you think of this otherwise? Talk to me. No.
Oh, I think his use of tender is interesting because tender has so many meanings to mm-hmm. it. So more ancient right. meanings of promises and also affection, gentleness.
Yeah. That's beautiful.
So it ties into me with the idea of utopia and that mm-hmm. this would be a legal bond.
Yeah, legal tender. Yeah, nice observation. Thank you. The word epiphany is kind of nice in there.
Yeah, I think he points out too, just because there's a lot of it doesn't mean it should be less value.
Yeah. Size. The mustard seed, the smallest of seeds and largest of shrubs. large enough to so the birds can come and roost and nest in it. Speaking of nest, let's go to the next one. Somebody care to read Mother Hunger?
Sure.
Please.
The hummingbird hovers momentarily in the rusty hulk of a car that plunged off the highway into the deep canyon years ago, and no one knows about. She perches on the skull of the driver and thinks, perhaps one of these eye holes would be a safe place for a nest.
Kind of morbid, isn't it? But this is a garbo, huh? All of these. Okay, let's start with the car. Goes off the cliff. What kind of status do cars bring in our society?
It's for a lot of people, it's a real status symbol.
And if you think about it, a car can almost whatever kind of status you want to portray. Mm-hmm. You can buy a Volkswagen bus in 1972 and drive it around, and that's a certain kind of image, isn't it? Or you can buy a 88 this or a 2003 Lexus or whatever it is, and cars are heavy, heavy, heavy symbols with status. So I think it's not by chance that he chose this to be a car. Plunges off the highway into the deep canyon, right? Which no one knows about, and this was years ago, no one knows about. So here's this deathly image, lost and dead person. What happens to the body of the person? Yeah, gone. The car is pretty much going to be gone to seed too, isn't it? Rust, decay, just everything. So the status, the symbol, all that wealth is rusted, gone. And the body's gone. What's left of this body? Pretty much bones, skull. So who comes along? The hummingbird. We have a lot of them up here, don't we? Hummingbirds, in some of the, I know the Baha'i faith, the hummingbird is a religious symbol of a kind of a messenger from God. And they're kind of a sacred bird to others in the East, too, in the Far East. Probably, I mean, there's, you know, they're a strange one. They do something real different, don't they? And they're so astounding and quiet until they get close and, I don't know, mysterious or mystical bird. But what happens? She perches on the skull, hovers momentarily at the very beginning. Then you get the story about why this car is here. The hummingbird doesn't know this as a car, doesn't know this as a person. What's on the hummingbird's mind?
Nesting,
which is life, new life. A message to us from this hummingbird, isn't it? And we weren't there to see it. He made this up, but he brought us to a place that he made up, so the metaphor can take us there too.
Interesting that the hummingbird is going to a place where we might have considered, because the car is down in this canyon, unsafe.
Yeah.
And yet this is now a safe
place. Yeah. Nice. I like the way you said that. Not only is the skull very safe, because man, a skull would be, you know, little lookouts, and, you know, just that hollow, very hard, nice, perfect, you know. But then it's also kind of sheltered again in the car. So you're going to have a porch or a deck or a patio or, I don't know, all those dials and who knows. The hope in this poem is about life, and the last 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 words or so, safe place for a nest. The word safety and the word nest. Isn't that what nature does and what life is always seeking? To create and to have new life and to stay. Safety is pretty primary. It is. Keep us safe, oh Lord. Turn toward the front again. See how we're doing on time here. And anybody here like Rumi or know Rumi? Would you like to read it?
Oh, I'll try my best. Sure. Look, fish. I saw the front clearly, and I stopped reading books and memorizing poems. I quit going to church
and I quit fasting to be a better person. I quit worrying about when I should be praying. I saw how I was undisciplined and toxic. I saw how lovely and strong. No mercy for the drunk, a full sentence. Let the beautiful one come out in fine clothes. Wind his hair into God's rope. Twist the braids into a cross for Christians to see. His light is better than the sun's. How could he have gotten so withered and weak? Now he jokes and pounds the table. He was wine under a lid, Joseph at the bottom of the well. Know yourself in the light of the true ones, as the ground sees its face in a garden, as rock knows its own secret, put next to a ruby, iron next to polished steel. Come into existence. Flies go round to every pile of dung, and finally out of that compost, the Anya bird, the true man. When a person is born of this new moment, it does not wear off tomorrow. Sit with lovers and be useful. Don't wander away. Look, fish, at the ocean behind you. Go back where you came from, sea creature. You hear the sound of water and you know where you want to be. Why wait? You've gone places you regret going for money and such. Don't do that again. Water says live here. Don't carry me around in buckets and pans. False duties. Rest and be quiet.
Pretty amazing for a 13th century, huh? Translated by Coleman Barks. 13th century Sufi poet, one of the masters of Sufism. So this was written in Persian, I think, first. Translating is hard, but I think he does a great job translating. The whirling dervishes, if you've heard about them, they kind of get stereotyped into this, but the Sufis are that group, kind of a small branch of the Muslim. But this was a flowering of Muslim culture in the same era, and Persian culture in the same time that medieval Europe was having its own flowering in the 13th, 14th centuries. What impressions do you get of this? There's a lot of, it's kind of an imagistic, kind of deep image poem in a way. What do you, what does it give to you or say to you, even in?
There's a kind of joy and release that it's not worrying anymore about
what
you should be doing. It's more in a release and enjoy of life.
I like the way you said that, kind of an enthusiastic kind of eagerness, but also relaxed, and kind of just let go. Someone else had a hand up? The friend, there's been lots of speculation among scholars whether the friend was a like a wife or spouse or mistress, and some say it might have been another mentor or a beloved friend in the Sufi order, or most people sort of think, presume that's God. And I tend to go with that. I think it fits. If you read a lot of Rumi, it fits. But so the friend or the beloved, the beautiful one, probably is God. He mentions Christians too, huh? In the middle of that second stanza, or the latter part of the second stanza, know yourself in the light of the true ones, as the ground sees its face in a garden. I love that.
Like that.
Back to that dirt, the ground sees its face in the garden, as a rock knows its own secret, put next to a ruby. Iron next to polished steel. These connections between nature that, you know, we can see them. If you let your brain go there, you can see them. come into existence. And then the flies, I think he goes around back to this dumb idea to kind of again show our kind of tendency to rot and to just waste away our time, waste away our life. Brings back a poem, if you like Walt Whitman, I'd go and read This Compost, really wonderful poem about compost. And I should have brought it in, but I didn't. The new moment, born again of a new moment. And then the title of the poem comes in there in the third stanza, Look, Fish. What's going on here with the look, fish, and the ocean and the water? What do you make of that?
It's almost if he knew before science discovered it or figured it out that that's where life on the planet began.
Okay. It's very primal. It's a creator's soup. What else? Any other thoughts about that?
Fish can't breathe out of water.
Right.
So it needs to go back.
Yeah. So he's saying, you know, what are you doing out of water? You know, that's not very smart. Don't do that. It's like this fish is on the shore looking at the beach house, and there's this whole ocean behind the fish. Just, you idiot, turn around. It's all there. You don't have to go very far. It's right there. What are you doing on land looking at that cabin? Or those, you know, it's the ocean. Go back where you came from. Go back to whom you belong. Sea creature, or God's creature, has the same idea. You hear the sound of the water. You know where you want to be. Why aren't you there? Why wait? Water says, live here. Don't carry me around in buckets. That contrasted to the ocean, carrying water around in a bucket is kind of utilitarian mundane or pedestrian. Rest and be quiet. He doesn't say, march on, swim for it. Rest and be quiet.
But he's also saying, wake up.
Yeah.
Because hey, you're doing some crazy things here.
Yeah.
You're going looking for money and such and who knows what else.
Right. Good. Yeah, good on. There's kind of a sermon here, I think. It's from a Sufi master. Maybe there are ways we can adapt to that and hear that too, I think. Born of the new moment, kind of like those seeds in that other poem, the seed has to sort of die or at least see beyond itself, if you want to personify that seed.
I was hearing a little bit too of Jesus talking here with you must be born from above, and because you have this person born of this new moment, and then you get water, and then you hear the sound of the water, and you know where you want to be, which reminds me of the wind blows where wills you. But you don't know where it comes from or where it goes, but
nice.
You're born of the spirit of the breath. So a lot of those images rattle around together.
I like that, very nice. Look, people, at the earth under your feet instead of, the fish. Look at the water behind you. Look, people, the earth. Walt Whitman has another in the Song of Myself. The press of my foot to the earth springs a thousand affections. This is one little line there. Come on. You know, and he goes on and on and on and on like Whitman does. It's like the songs. In fact, when I was in grad school in my MFA, my advisor told me, well, you got to read Whitman because he was strongly influenced by the Old Testament and the Psalms, especially King James. Walt Whitman was not kind of castigated a lot of Christians, but he even tried to study Hebrew. He fell so deeply in love with the Old Testament, and especially the Psalms and wisdom literature. And there have actually been studies where they look at the influence of Hebrew poetry on Whitman's own poetry and what they call parallelism. It's very fascinating. So, I can kind of see him as an Old Testament bard. He wouldn't like me saying that, but he'd like the bard part. Let's read Reason. Let's see how we do it. We don't don't have much time. This will probably be our last one for the day. That's not right. Reason. Scott Cairns, there are two of his books, actually just one. I hope to have two. This one's in the bookstore if you like his poetry, and this one's also in the bookstore, kind of an anthology about this idea of sacred places and sacred earth and the ground and all sorts of various authors. Really good book. This one I just put up here because we were talking about the land. Anyway, this is Scott Cairns' poem. He was a Seattle Pacific professor for about 3 months until even signed a contract, never got to teach a class, and was fired before he got to teach a class from Seattle Pacific University. Mm-hmm. So he hired, they interviewed, hired, signed a contract. Somebody in the regent's office found about 8 years previous to him being hired, he had several books of poems published. There were about five poems in a group that were kind of erotically written about, with erotic imagery about God. And for that reason, they fired him. It caused a stir about 2 years ago, a year and a half ago in Seattle, and hit the national press. It was in the Christian Century because of the freedom of speech, freedom of religion, the role of poetry in the university, especially a Christian university. It's kind of interesting. So if you want to check up on that, I think it was February issue of Christian Century.
Here's a poem in this week's magazine as well, actually. It just came out, just came today.
Really?
Yeah.
One of his?
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah.
Where does he live now?
I think he got a job in Tennessee or Arkansas, like West Tennessee College or something. So, that's another interesting story, and maybe we're going to talk ourselves out of time, but I should tell it. He was interested in economics or sociology, I forget which one, and he was a student, undergrad, at Western Washington University in Bellingham, over north of Seattle, north of Everett. Talked with an advisor. Advisor said, well, you need an English class. You need English credits to get to your degree, so probably got to take one. So they just, she said, well, throw this one in there. So, okay, didn't even look. It's just any English class. It had to be the right number, like 220 or 201 or whatever. He got to class figuring I'll have to put up with this and do my time. And it was the most life-changing experience ever because Annie Dillard was a guest professor for 2 months. She lived in an Orcas Island and some of the San Juan Islands for about a year during that point in her life, and came and in Western Washington invited her to teach there for about a half a year while she was finishing up her novel called The Living. Anyway, Annie Dillard just took a can opener to his brain. And he didn't know who Annie Dillard was when he walked in there, but like eventually found out. What a story. There's some of Annie Dillard's things in this too. Let's read this and then we just won't talk about it. Because you don't have to. Reason. It could be a late night phone call or a note you find troubling the bed. It could be a telegram you can't help going back to. But something has died or has left you, and you can't remember which. You do know that you sit alone, that you have 10 strange fingers, and that something whistles in your lungs. Odd the way a face hangs so heavily and can seem to pull you over, can seem to pull you down. If your hand were to change, become something altogether different, say, a grip of flowers or a club of dirt, you might understand the strangeness, might say out loud, there. That's the problem. Something's changed my hand to dirt. Now there's the union in the mind, but maybe it's even a death. I think there's a death illusion there. Maybe this is, you know, when your body goes to dust. But I think he's even talking about just a mystical kind of returning, you know, imagining where that hand, all these other places this hand takes you. You need to read that one again and study it. Before we break and cut you loose, One of my all-time favorite poems is that Dylan Thomas one. Beautiful, beautiful poem. I would highly recommend you read The Turning of Lot's Wife, also by Scott Cairns. It's a real Bible study all by itself, from the point of view of Mara, Lot's wife. Why did she do what she did? Why? And it's kind of a reinterpretation of the text or a filling in of blanks, but it's very, I think it's a beautiful poem. And last but not least, on the very back page, anybody know who Carl Wojtyla is?
Yeah.
John Paul. John Paul II? This poem was written way back in his monastery days before he was a bigwig. It's a good poem. I tried to find reasons not to throw it in there. That's the Pope. But hey, that's a great poem. It goes with the theme. Thank you for being a part of this and a poetry enthusiast, and I'll stick around for a while. I do have a couple of handouts from the last two times if you wanted to try to catch up on handouts from before. Thank you very much. Thank you.